Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Russian threat to invade Ukraine took an interesting turn today. Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov, provided details of a proposed sweeping new security arrangement with NATO. Moscow requests a written guarantee that NATO will not expand further east toward Russia and that NATO will remove all military infrastructure installed in Eastern Europe after 1997. Now, if NATO agreed, Russia says it would end all military activity in Ukraine and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Well, NATO responded quickly with a statement, quote, "NATO will take all necessary measures to ensure the security and defense of all NATO allies. Any further aggression against Ukraine would have massive consequences and would carry a high price." The statement goes on, quote, "We are ready for meaningful dialogue with Russia. We reiterate our long-standing invitation to Russia for a meeting of the NATO-Russia Council in the near future. We are aware of Russia's recent European security proposals. We are clear that any dialogue with Russia would have to proceed on the basis of reciprocity. Should Russia take concrete steps to reduce tensions, we are prepared to work on strengthening confidence-building measures," end quote. And yesterday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg tried to strike a similar diplomatic balance. On the one hand, calling Russia a, quote, "nation in decline."
But even an economy in decline and a power in economic decline can be a threat and a challenge. And we have, because not least because Russia has nuclear weapons.
Which, therefore, Stoltenberg said means NATO must resist Russian aggression. However, he then pirouetted again.
At the same time, we don't see any imminent threat against any NATO ally, not least because NATO is there. We are 30 allies ready to protect and defend each other, and together we are 50% of the world's GDP and 50% of the world's military might, and as long as we stand together, we are safe.
Given the moment-by-moment developments regarding Russia and NATO, today we're turning to an unrivaled expert who can help us best understand the situation overall. Fiona Hill joins us. She served as the National Security Council's top Russia expert in the Trump administration from 2017 to 2019. Today, she's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and more recently, her memoir published this year, There Is Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. Fiona Hill, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna. Thanks for having me here today.
We're really privileged to have you, actually. So help us first understand these most recent developments. What do you make of this security proposal that Moscow is offering to NATO?
Well, to put it in a context, actually a much larger context, this is another variation with a few differences of a series of proposals that Russia has put forward over the course of the last decade or more. In 2007-2008, when Dmitry Medvedev was filling in for Vladimir Putin as president of the Russian Federation, he made a proposal for a new European security order in Berlin and a visit to Germany. And in 2017, about 10 years after this, at the beginning of the Trump administration, the Russians handed to the US government, to the State Department, it was the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, to then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, another proposal for European security arrangements, including various discussions of NATO. It's no secret that, of course, Russia has been very much opposed to the expansion of NATO to the east into the countries of the former Soviet bloc, not just to Ukraine and other former Russian or Soviet republics like Georgia, for example, but also not at all happy about the expansion of NATO in the early 2000s to the Baltic states, to Poland, Czech Republic and Slovakia, Hungary, for example. Mm-hmm. So this has been an ongoing issue. So just for listeners to understand this larger context, we've had this standoff about NATO and its expansion to the east for some time. including also the question about deployments of forces that come under the NATO umbrella in all of these countries. Because going back to the 1990s and the end of the Cold War, I mean, we're talking about 30 years ago since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's been a back and forth about whether NATO forces or military forces should expand into the territory in terms of permanent deployment, setting up bases. That's one of the issues that you cited there at the very beginning, in the territories of the former Warsaw Pact countries, which includes Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, for example, as
well. So there's a decades-long background to this. And Vladimir Putin's view and Russia's view of this is something that I want to explore with you in depth over the course of the hour, Fiona Hill. But first of all, just for the sake of asking, are the terms of the security proposal that Moscow has offered, are they essentially a non-starter for NATO right now?
Well, it depends. A lot of this is open to interpretation. And clearly, the intention on both sides, as if you've heard Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, stake out the issue. The United States government has made some comments on this. I mean, all of these documents have now been posted on various websites in Russian and in English, so you know, people can take a look at them as well and pass through them. You know, the Russians have staked out some pretty maximalist expectations. And, you know, the art of diplomacy is trying to see if you can find some way of, you know, bringing these together to find some threshold of issues that you can talk about that, you know, kind of meet minimum expectations. So this is the opening gambit in yet another set piece set of discussions. The question, of course, is, given the urgency of the issue with Russian forces pretty much poised to strike on Ukraine, whether we can get something underway with sufficient enough speed that that will start to put things into a diplomatic rather than a military frame.
Aha. Okay. So speed is of the essence to change the frame. But so for people who haven't actually been following along in detail and maybe wondering, why is Russia even threatening to invade Ukraine? Does this latest security proposal really sort of give us a clear answer to that? It's not so much about simply taking or claiming Ukrainian territory for Russia, but rather, is this Vladimir Putin's way of saying, unless we become overtly belligerent, the West isn't going to listen to us regarding these long-standing Russian views of NATO encroachment in Eastern Europe?
That's exactly right, Magda. That's, in fact, almost explicitly what Putin is being saying. Now surely you'll listen to us. I mean, basically, a lot of this goes back to 2007. So we keep having to go back in time to sort of frame things. When Putin made a pretty significant speech at the Munich Security Conference, this annual meeting of national security experts from all around Europe and the United States, it's been going on, you know, since the Cold War. And there he basically made a declaration that sort of said, no more Mr. Nice Guy, although people hadn't necessarily been perceiving him as that in any case. But, you know, we, Russia, have been sitting, you know, watching the eastward expansion of NATO and European institutions. We've said many, many times since going back to the 1990s that we're not happy with this arrangement, that we want a special arrangement with Russia to mark the end of the Cold War. And we now feel in a position that we will take some action if you continue. Now, this kind of roiled European capitals, but no one was quite sure what he had in mind until pretty much the following year in 2008, when Ukraine, along with Georgia, made an appeal to NATO for a membership action plan. So made it very explicit that they wanted to join NATO. And that's when Russia reacted. There was a NATO summit in the Romanian capital of Bucharest in the spring of 2008, in April. And Ukraine and Georgia did not get that membership action plan because there was a lot of resistance among pretty important NATO allies, not the United States, which championed this under George W. Bush, but the Germans, the French, and many others, were very worried in the light of Putin's speech and all this other activity preceding that, that Russia would take some kind of strong action in response, which in fact they did, because they had been threatening a military response, but no one was sure whether they were bluffing or not. And this is what's important for now. You know, are they bluffing or are they not?
Okay.
What happened was they moved into Georgia in the August of 2008, making it clear that Russia was prepared to take military action in response to what they felt they were not being listened to. So that's the threat for today. August 2008 when they basically move into Georgia to make sure that Georgia does not pursue NATO membership.
Okay, so forgive the interruption there, but I guess what I was going to ask is, I mean, in that case, from the Russian perspective, this is an effective strategy, is it not?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, we also saw them, so just to be clear again, and I mean, you pretty much framed it like this, Russia's already invaded Ukraine. It annexed the Crimean Peninsula in 2014, in March of that year, when Ukraine wanted to associate with the European Union, not even with NATO, making it clear that that was also impermissible. And it also then started off a proxy war or a civil war. I mean, it's been called various things, but it's really a war that Russia sparked off in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region that continues to rage today. And all of that was basically messaging Ukraine, no, this is not acceptable for you to move closer to European institutions. And the Russians started at that point to say that the European Union and a close association with Europe through that way was a backdoor into NATO, because the European Union countries, they're not all members of NATO, but they do have close common security and defence policy links and as part of the European programmes. So we've been in this situation for quite some time. And just as you say, for Vladimir Putin, it's been very effective to demonstrate very clearly that he means business with military force if he doesn't get what he wants in the diplomatic arena.
Well, we have a listener on Facebook saying the buildup, the Russian buildup, began as soon as they knew Biden would not act. We have about 30 seconds, Fiona Hill, before our first break. Do you want to just give us your quick first thoughts on how the Biden administration has been handling this, let's say, in the past week or two?
Well, I think what the listener is referring to is back in the summer, there was the buildup that began, certainly to get the attention of the incoming Biden administration to make sure that this was not forgotten and was on the agenda. And there was the summit meeting that we may recall in Geneva between Biden and Putin. And after that, I think Putin was expecting some major progress on this larger issue of European security, NATO enlargement in Ukraine. And of course, that didn't happen. So, you know, the listener is correct. They've built up again to show their main business.
Well, we're joined today by Fiona Hill. She served as the National Security Council's top Russia expert in the Trump administration. She's author of a new memoir called There's Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. She's one of the world's top experts on Russia. And we're seeking her help to understand this moment in Russia, NATO, and U.S. relations. And when we come back, we'll talk in much more detail about how Vladimir Putin sees the world right now. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are joined by Fiona Hill. She served as the National Security Council's top Russia expert in the Trump administration, one of the unrivaled experts on Russia worldwide. She's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of There Is Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. That's her memoir out this year. I want to listen a little bit, if we could, to what Vladimir Putin himself has said about the situation in Ukraine. So this is from an interview that Putin gave back in June of this year, June 14th, 2021, where he was asked if he would commit to not sending any further Russian troops into Ukrainian sovereign territory.
Look, did we say that we were planning to send our armed formations anywhere? We conducted war games in our territory. How can this not be clear? I'm saying it again because I want your audience to hear it. I want your listeners to hear it, both on the screens of their television sets and on the internet. We conducted military exercises in our territory. Imagine if we sent our troops into direct proximity to your borders. What would have been your response? We didn't do that. We did it in our territory. You conducted war games in Alaska. God bless you. But you had crossed an ocean, brought thousands of personnel and thousands of units of military equipment close to our borders, and yet you believe that we are acting aggressively, and somehow you're not. Just look at that. Pot calling the kettle black.
Vladimir Putin in June of this year, of course, you're hearing him there through an interpreter. Well, this past weekend, Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained on Meet the Press what the American people need to understand about the more recent Russian military activity on the Russian-Ukrainian border. Blinken says Ukraine and its sovereignty are important to the United States. And he also says there's something even bigger at stake.
And it's the basic rules of the road of the international system. Rules that say that one country can't change the borders of another by force. One country can't dictate to another country its choices, its decisions, and its foreign policy with whom it will associate. One country can't exert a sphere of influence over others. That's what Russia is purporting to assert. And if we let that go with impunity, then the entire system that provides for stability, prevents war from breaking out, is in danger.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken there from just a few days ago. Fiona Hill, returning to the June 2021 interview that we played there of Putin, explain what he's thinking or why he points out, again, that what he calls aggression, essentially the NATO buildup in Eastern Europe. He even points to, you know, U.S. war gaming. Take us into his mind about why those are the things that he points out in terms of what he explicitly calls Western hypocrisy.
Well, what he's implying there, though, is that there are exercises, you know, kind of on a very large scale going on Ukrainian soil. I mean, if people were kind of, you know, putting it into that framework, which is not the case. Now, however, there were some exercises in the Black Sea, an exercise that NATO naval forces took part in called Sea Breeze. And just to be very clear, the Black Sea is not an inland lake of the Russian Federation. Russia's position on the Black Sea was expanded in 2014 through the annexation of Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. But Ukraine maintains, and of course we've not recognized that, just to be clear, but Ukraine retains a large Black Sea coastline, irrespective of the annexation. Bulgaria and Romania are Black Sea forces, and they're members of NATO, though they used to be part of the Warsaw Treaty Organization, Eastern Bloc. The Republic of Georgia, independent country, also part of the former Soviet Union initially, was also a Black Sea power, as is Turkey, which has been a long-standing NATO member. Russia is also trying to claim dominance of the Black Sea and also of a kind of a sort of an inland, more of an inland sea, the Sea of Azov, which also has Ukrainian and Russian territory there. And during the Soviet period, of course, Russia did dominate that whole of the Black Sea region. So there's a lot of tensions there. It's not just on the land in Ukraine. But again, what he's referring to is something I mentioned earlier, is this history of NATO expansion and that Russia contests, and Russia maintains that but dating back to the 1990s, lots of things have been written about this, several books, you know, by a prominent scholar, Maria Lee Sarotti, for example, that explain in the 1990s that there was this debate about the deployment of forces on a permanent basis by NATO, NATO members, this has to be said, within the territories of the former Warsaw Treaty Organization, so Poland, as well as former Soviet republics like the Baltic states that are now there. But you remember in the NATO context, a lot of these forces that belong to NATO are the country's national forces themselves. And the United States since World War II, of course, does have forces stationed in Europe, particularly in Germany. But these are long-standing forces. It's a question of whether US and other forces move into these former Eastern Bloc countries. It's extremely complicated. And Putin simplifies it, obviously, to his own advantage when he talks about this. But there's no question that he and the Russians, the Russian security services, the military find this deeply threatening, this idea of the encroachment and encirclement of NATO, as they call it, into that former space of the Warsaw right. Treaty Organization.
So I want to understand more deeply how, you know, almost in a personal sense, Vladimir Putin sees this, because
yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was in that same period of the 90s when Putin was posted, what, in Eastern Germany when he was with the KGB? Is that right?
Well, it was actually the 80s that he was there. But
the
that
80s.
Is significant. You're absolutely right that that has a big impression on him. So he was stationed in Dresden in East Germany in Saxony. And this is at the end of the Cold War period, the peak of kind of Gorbachev perestroika when the Soviet Union is faltering. And he experiences there the implosion of East Germany, the GDR, under Erich Honecker. And, you know, basically that was the most successful part of the Eastern Bloc countries, highly militarized state. And it just literally crumbles and falls apart. And then, of course, in 1991, in December, the Soviet Union itself collapses, sort of picked apart by all the internal elite fighting. And Putin's come back in the 1990s, to a Russia that's lost its place in Europe. And he expresses this very clearly. I mean, I think we're all familiar, everybody listening, with Putin's comment that the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union, the loss of the Russian state and the loss of the Russian Empire. And of course, it had done that once before too, in 1917, after the Bolshevik Revolution. And so for Putin, the whole frame for the next 30 years is one of loss of Russia's position. Now, of course, he gains immensely personally. He goes to work as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, and then he goes from there on a meteoric rise to become president of Russia. That would never have happened had the Soviet Union held together. He might have been still in the backwater position in the old KGB, maybe, you know, in another place in the Eastern Bloc. But although he gets considerable personal gain, for his whole frame, just as you're suggesting, it's one of loss.
Right.
And Ukraine is a big part of that loss, because it's the biggest chunk of the former Soviet Union. Ukraine and Belarus both had this special position in the USSR and also had seats in the United Nations. They were kind of titular nominal seats, but in a way they were also symbolic of the USSR. Mm-hmm. And so for Putin, a lot of things about the future of Russia, for him, that sense of loss and how to restore the Russian statehood and Russia's position in Europe circles around Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, so, and he has spoken explicitly about this. Here's a moment from the end of Vladimir Putin's 2018 State of the Nation address that he gave in Russia of March 1st of that year.
We need to be courageous and brave. We need to take the responsibility and the obligations to become stronger and better, benefiting our family, our people, our country, changing the life to the better, creating a Russia which we are dreaming of. Then the upcoming decades, the whole 21st century, will be the time of our victories, of our common success. And I believe that this is going to be the case. Thank you.
Again, an interpreter there speaking or interpreting Vladimir Putin's 2018 State of the Nation address. Fiona Hilda, let me just ask, there's another wrinkle here, because I wonder if, I mean, you talk, this Russian greatness idea sort of intrinsically puts into mind sort of czarist imperialism. But you also mentioned World War II, and we have to note that, I mean, the Russians lost 20 million people in the Second World War, right? I mean, I think at that point in time, it was 1 in 5 Russians were killed. And so does it not make sense that in the minds of someone like Vladimir Putin, that if you want to talk about aggression, that it has historically come from Russia's West, and that the Cold War period, the Iron Curtain period, at least provided a territorial and ideological buffer between the then Soviet Union and the sources of aggression that cost the lives of 20 million Russians for at least several decades.
Yeah, just for clarification, this was not just the deaths of Russians.
Correct.
Because it was the Soviet Union.
Yes, correct.
So
correct.
A very large, yeah. I mean, we often, I mean, I do the same thing, often conflate, you know, the two, you know, when you're kind of talking.
No, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right to correct
and
that.
And a lot of those deaths were on the territory of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So there were millions of Ukrainians who died, and then there were famines and other things that, you know, kind of, you know, succeeded the war. A lot of people died, not just in the conflict, but of disease, you know, the starvation. There was a lot going on in that period, and there was going to massive number of deaths on the Crimean Peninsula of Crimean Tatars, Turkic people who were, you know, indigenous to the peninsula. And, you know, this was suffering across the whole of the Soviet Union. But absolutely right. It's all tied up now with the kind of Russia's image of itself, the great impact of World War II. That has become part of the story of Russia and of modern Russia, of going through this great suffering, and also in the larger historical sweep. Putin sees himself in many respects the inheritor of the czars, not just of the Soviet leadership. His name, Vladimir, comes from the Grand Prince of Kiev, one of the founders of at least the early Russian state in the kind of this historical sense. He is very proud of, you know, that name and the kind of the namesake. Of course, that gets also back into the sort of mythologizing and historical narrative about, you know, the origins of modern Russia. There's links there to Crimea and to Kiev as well. And he sees also his legacy is tied up in that great suffering, but also the great victory at an enormous cost of World War II. And in fact, they've even passed legislation in Russia, we've seen this happen in Poland and other places as well, that really constrain alternative narratives about the origins of World War II and what happened, that there's kind of now an official state narrative that people can actually be, you know, taken to court and have ruling against if they, you know, somehow refute it in some way. So, you know, this has become a really important political issue, and it's tied into that whole issue now of Putin's own personal legacy as president and his current role.
Right. So, just to bring it back into this moment and you know what's happened today with the proposed security pact that Moscow has offered to NATO. Just game this out with me, Fiona Hill. I mean, what would NATO stand to lose if it said if it agreed to Russians' demands to, let's say, first of all, withdraw military installations that NATO has put into Eastern Europe since the late 1990s?
Well, it depends what they mean by that, because again, just to remember that NATO is a membership organization. There's no separate NATO apart from the headquarters in Belgium. This is going to be something that has to be clarified and negotiated in terms of NATO installations, because these are often the installations, with the exception of, you know, the US bases in places like Germany, that were established by the countries themselves, the NATO member countries. And as Poland is a NATO member country, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and the Baltic states are, and others, what does that mean? So, I mean, clearly, as is being discussed by Secretary Blinken and General Secretary Stoltenberg, you know, we're going to frame a set of negotiations and discussions here. There's a request for bilateral talks with the United States, which are going on anyway. The United States already has strategic stability talks with Russia, which talk about our nuclear arsenals respective. They're also enlarging out to talk about cyber confrontation, which, you know, we've seen an awful lot of at different levels, and other, you know, issues of mutual bilateral concern. But in the NATO context, we've been talking to the Russians for a long time. There's the creation of a NATO-Russia Council, which Secretary General Stoltenberg was talking about. But Russia wants more than that. It doesn't just want a consultative council, which is what the NATO-Russia Council was, where the dialogue is continuing to have a Russian mission. In fact, they've pulled out a lot of the people in their mission after some were expelled for so-called malign activity, you know, ACA spying and, you know, other actions there. They want something that gives them a veto over NATO issues. And so they're scoping out again something that they've been saying for some time and goes back to deliberations in the 1990s about the definition of deployments and infrastructure.
Right.
So we're going to be thrashing this out again. This is going to go on for a long time, just to be clear to listeners. This is not going to be something that's going to be easily resolved. It's got this long history, which is complicated and complex, and lots of different players in it. This is going to be an effort in really serious diplomatic crisis management, and it's not clear that we're going to be able to find a solution that's satisfactory to both sides.
So, but, you know, NATO did expand eastward, and at the request of many of those new member states, of course. But it has been asked before, and I'm just curious what you think. Was that actually a mistake? Was it necessary for NATO in terms of its fundamental mission as a protective alliance? Did it need to actually expand that far eastward?
Well, it depends again on the perspective, right? You just said that the Poles, for example, the Balts, Lithuanians, Estonians, Latvians, Hungarians, the Czechs, the Slovaks, and others, you know, wanted to be members of NATO for protection from Russia because they did not believe that Russia would, you know, kind of remain marginalized as it was initially after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, that the Russian military would come back and want to regather the lands of the former Eastern Bloc, potentially, not just the former Soviet Union. Remember, for the Baltic states, we never recognized their annexation after World War II. They had been independent in the interwar period. And so, you know, for the Baltic states, basically heading off annexation was especially important. There are also two other countries that we don't mention very frequently, Sweden and Finland. Finland was once part of the Russian Empire and also gained its independence. And then there were efforts to bring Finland back in during World War II, the so-called Winter War in the 1940s, in which the Soviet Union, you know, did the same to Finland, did to the Baltic states, and tried to reincorporate it. And Finland managed to fight the Soviet Union off, but lost a huge swathe of territory of Karelia. And Sweden and Finland are close partners of NATO, and they want to retain that close partnership. They are also very nervous about the implications of any agreement with Russia on this front.
Well, Fiona Hill, stand by for just a moment. We will be taking another quick break here. And when we come back, I want to hear a story or two from you about some of the personal interactions that you had with Vladimir Putin. And also, we'll take a much closer look at how Washington's response across a couple of administrations has complicated the matter of what we see with Russia and Ukraine today. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick preview on what we'll be doing on Monday. We're going to be talking about the fact that major federal legislation regarding child safety on the internet hasn't been updated in more than 20 years. And just imagine how much the internet and digital technology has changed since then. So grown-ups, adults, caregivers, parents, families, we want to hear from you, your stories, how much digital information and technology has already embedded itself into the youngest members of your family or their lives, I should say, the pressures of social media, etc. What kinds of protections would you like to see the federal government put into place regarding children and the internet? And can those protections be put into place while also staying within the bounds of freedom of speech and the law? So call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. 3530683. We're going to be talking about children and child safety on the internet on Monday. Today, we are speaking with Fiona Hill. She's one of the top Russia and Eastern Europe experts just about anywhere. She served as the National Security Council's top Russia advisor in the Trump administration, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. That's her memoir out this year. And Fiona Hill, in your memoir, you have a lot, but one particular great, really fascinating story about Vladimir Putin. And it takes place in 2011 at a dinner where you were seated next to Putin. And at the time, you had wondered, why you? And in the book, you write, quote, "I was one of the few women in the group, but the Russians did not see me as a real-life version of the celebrated British actress Judi Dench playing the part of M, the first top female spy chief in a James Bond movie. No, I had been selected because of something far more prosaic. Who I was professionally was immaterial. I was merely a decorative prop for the great man. I was a woman who was neither too ugly nor too attractive, neither too young nor too old. I had the elusive Goldilocks factor. No one, apart from the very few people in Russian foreign policy circles who might know who I was, would pay attention to me. All eyes would be on him." What did that tell you about Putin?
Well, it told me an awful lot about Putin and the larger Russian system. And, you know, I did treat it with some degree of humor in the time as well, because I'd actually, when I was sitting next to him, I was the National Intelligence Officer for Russia at the National Intelligence Council. You know, basically the chief analyst for all the intelligence agencies. And I just thought to myself, oh my God, are they trying to put me in an awkward position here? And then when I found out why it was, I just thought it was hysterical in some respects. But what it told me, of course, is that, you know, Putin and the people around him, you know, they're highly attuned to the optics, to the staging of every event, you know, which ties into what we've been talking about, right, about Ukraine and Russia as well. There's a lot going on, but staging things in the right way, creating a sense of urgency, emergency, but in this case at the dinner, basically a framing so that everybody would be focused on Putin. This dinner was very important for him. It's 2011. At this point, the United States is kind of moving quite aggressively from his point of view into the energy sector in ways that might be threatening to Russia. This was kind of at the sort of peak energy prices. And the United States was developing fracking for shale oil and shale gas. And we were becoming much more of a major energy supplier. And of course, that's the bread and butter literally for the Russian state. And Putin was hoping to be able to make some pretty strong pronouncements, anti-fracking and kind of, you know, whipping up sentiment against this in Europe. And he wanted to make sure there was no distraction, you know, whatsoever. So that's why I ended up being seated there, because all of the other participants in the group who were men were, you know, actually representatives of, you know, kind of major universities and think tanks, sometimes spy agencies, even former, there was the former head of MI6 who was there. And if they'd been seated next to Putin, people would have spent the whole time wondering who they were and might not have been paying attention to what Putin himself was saying.
Wow. So by virtue of being a woman, people wouldn't pay attention to you if only they knew who you actually were. What else did you notice about him that night?
Well, it was a fantastic opportunity for me, I have to say, because, you know, as I was then, you know, the chief analyst for the intelligence agencies, I'd already been, you know, given the sort of, you know, things to look out for, because we were trying to glean as much information as we possibly could about Putin's personal conduct at that time. You know, for many years, it was very difficult to, you know, to get people in such close proximity who'd be able to notice things about him. And of course, you know, there's a lot of superficial things I noticed: the cut of his suit, you know, handmade shoes, very expensive watch, but very understated. The fact, of course, that he never ate or drank anything, which is somewhat disconcerting when you're sitting next to someone at dinner. I mean, it did make me wonder about, you know, kind of whether anybody else should be eating and drinking things, but, you know, very, you know, disciplined. But the other one really notable thing was that clearly, like the rest of us who are advanced in age, he was short-sighted. And his note cards, you know, to prepare him for his interactions with everyone, were in very large font, and I could read them. And of course, he kept trying to move them away because he realized that I was could read them as well. And, you know, it was fascinating, you know, kind of basically seeing, you know, what he had on the cards, which were kind of prompts for interacting with people. So we'd have all these little details and things about them. But the very large font gave it away because, of course, I'm so close, I can see he's not wearing contact lenses. He's not wearing glasses. obviously, and we've never seen him in glasses apart from aviator sunglasses. It's all part of that image, that, you know, kind of image of a person who's ageless and always in command of his faculties and everything else about it. And anyway, there was just the whole staging of it showed how much preparation and effort they go into thinking about how Putin interacts with the crowd and how he exerts influence.
Wow. You know, the note cards remind me of something that happened in the Trump administration when former President Trump's briefing papers, I think this was around 2018, there was a note to not congratulate Russian President Vladimir Putin on a phone call between the two men, but he ignored that. Then President Trump ignored that. Let me ask you, I mean, of course, we have to talk a little bit about what you saw during your time at the NSC in the Trump administration. So let me frame it this way. How much of how President Trump approached Russia and specifically approached Vladimir Putin, does that continue to reverberate now in regards to how Putin sees even the Biden administration or the U.S. in general?
Well, I think there's a lot of reverberations. First of all, President Trump actually fell into a pattern, of U.S. presidents who've tried to create a personal relationship with Putin. You know, so this goes back to, of course, very famously George W. Bush, who has a meeting with Putin early on in his tenure in Slovenia, in which he famously looks into Putin's eyes and, you know, gets the measure of him, the measure of his soul, and decides that Putin is a patriot that he can try to do business with. But of course, he gets roundly criticized and mocked, you know, for even saying this. And Colin Powell and many others who, you know, work with Bush at the time say they looked into Putin's soul as well, and they saw KGB, KGB, KGB. So, you know, there's that, putting that into that frame. But Trump, you know, more so than any of his predecessors who've tried to effect a relationship with the Russian leader, recognizing, of course, that there's a very vertical system of power in Russia. You have to always deal with the guy at the top because that's the only voice that matters. But Trump tries to hyper-personalize this. It's not about US and Russia, it's just about him and Putin. And of course, that in the context of Russia's efforts to mess about in our 2016 presidential election campaign creates kind of toxic atmosphere, certainly in the United States. And that kind of suspicion about interactions between, you know, Trump and Putin have certainly shaped, you know, kind of perspectives on Biden meeting with Putin, for example. There was a lot of criticism and concern about Biden meeting with Putin in the summit in Geneva back in the summer. There was also that worries about, you know, kind of how can one sustain any kind of personal relationship with Putin. I think, you know, President Biden decided not to try, right? Mm. He's met Putin before when he was vice president. He already knows him. There's not a kind of get to know you session, but there's a desire to kind of frame the overall US-Russia relationship absent what have often been seen as futile attempts to kind of create a relationship at the top. We've had all these ups and downs in the US-Russian relationship, and we've always had this failure of that personal connection. I mean, the last time we had a series of successful personal connections was Reagan and Gorbachev, and then later Clinton and Yeltsin, and those two, you know, had their limitations. Yeah. So I think that's kind of part of our problem is how do we frame dealing with Putin himself personally, and then how do we frame dealing with Russia and the United States. And, you know, Trump was very focused on having, although this gets lost in the mix as well, a nuclear arms deal with Russia, which is still possible. But he wasn't at all interested in dealing with Ukraine, except for, unfortunately, you know, what we learned in the first impeachment trial, efforts to get the Ukrainians to assist him in, you know, really is the beginning of his re-election campaign in 2020 and a big scandal. And I think just, you know, very quickly, one of the issues that the Russians are reacting so forcefully now is because the Biden administration, when they came in, immediately tried to restore this traditional linkage on European security in Ukraine and reinvigorating the idea that NATO and Ukraine, you know, could have a closer partnership over the time that, of course, disappeared completely under the Trump administration. And even though there was no real dramatic change, the fact that the US apparatus, the US government, started to pay more attention to Ukraine, it wasn't in the realm of our crazy domestic politics, really got the Kremlin and Moscow's attention. And they're trying to kind of push back.
Okay. So it makes me wonder, though, As with so many things, I think in recent geopolitical-based conversations that we've had, it seems like one of the places we ought to be putting a lot of focus is right here in the United States. Because I do wonder if Vladimir Putin looks at the election of Donald Trump and then, you know, the Trump presidency as the real revelatory moment for the United States. I guess what I'm trying to say is he just waiting out the Biden administration? And could Vladimir Putin just be thinking, well, we already know what the U.S. is capable of regarding putting a person like Donald Trump into office. Biden's just an interim blip. And let's wait until 2024.
Interestingly, I think that one of the senses of urgency about this is precisely because of the risks of Trump coming back in 2024. Let me just kind of point out what this was. The Russians love the chaos in our politics, our continued chaos in our politics, the deep partisan fighting, the polarization. They love the fact that people thought that they had elected Donald Trump. I mean, this was just, you know, kind of an enormous success for their propaganda and influence operation, something they would never expect in the Soviet period. However, that only goes so far because the Russians wanted deals. They thought Trump would bring them deals, and he did not and he could not because of the domestic situation and, you know, his own lack of discipline, obviously. They see Biden as very disciplined. They see Biden as somebody who has a grasp on foreign and security policy. They know now that the United States is completely focused on China, which it was in the Trump administration. That was one thing that Trump was really focused on and actually did change the course of U.S. policy in a major way, and that the Biden administration has picked up where Trump left off on China. And what they're worried about is that this administration wants to park Russia somewhere where they focus on China and, you know, is going to kind of continue with this longer kind of thread of US foreign policy towards Russia and the whole European security in which Russia successfully gets marginalized. There is no way they want that. But they do think that Biden has the discipline and the inclination to perhaps make some of these deals. The Biden administration already agreed to extend the New START treaty that was expiring at the very beginning of their presidency, for example. They've engaged in these strategic stability talks. They've been serious about, you know, at least having stable and predictable, as they say, relationships with Russia in the sense of having meetings with the National Security Councils, meetings at the Secretary of State level, and other, you know, working groups. But for Russia, that's not enough. You know, they want this big deal. And I think they're aware that if 2024 comes along, you know, a new Trump administration wouldn't do that. There'd be no interest in this. So they're actually putting, I think, in many respects, Biden's feet to the fire so that they can get something while Biden is still in office. So it's kind of like slightly counterintuitive. They love the chaos of the Trump administration, the weakening of the United States impact, you know, globally, the way that people then no longer see the United States as the leader on so many different fronts, you know, the marginalization in many respects of the United States and the focus on our domestic policy. But they want something concrete, and they think that Biden is the person that they can secure those kinds of deals with.
So very briefly then, because there's another last couple of questions I want to ask you, but very briefly, should that put some motivation in the Biden administration to take advantage of the that time, even if it's coming following Vladimir Putin's, you know, strategy to use like a military lever to force deals or conversations?
Look, I do think it's incumbent upon us to find some kind of formula that lasts, you know, longer than a couple of years to manage this relationship. I mean, we've been trying to do this since the end of the Cold War. And in the 1980s, you know, as the Cold War was coming towards an end, although we didn't know it at the time, the Reagan-Gorbachev symmetry did stabilize international affairs. You know, why I talk in my book, in fact, about, you know, that whole period of the 1980s. I was actually a student in Moscow at the time when Gorbachev and Reagan had their Moscow summit. And, you know, we all breathed a sigh of relief. We kind of thought that the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this was a whole kind of period where we'd have things resolved. But all the kinds of misunderstandings and misperceptions and different views of things in the 1990s about NATO and everything else have kind of led us to this point. So it is incumbent upon us to figure out how to manage what is now a really confrontational and very dangerous relationship. And if we are to deal with all the other issues on our agenda, domestic, you know, renewal that the Biden administration is trying to tackle and that, you know, the Trump administration tried to tackle as well, the whole issues of China, the rising China challenge, COVID pandemic, climate change, you know, you name it, we do need to find some way of stabilizing the Russian relationship. In other words, stopping us from careening from one crisis to the next. And certainly we don't want them to invade Ukraine.
So we have 45 seconds left, Fiona Hill.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay. In 2019, you did testify during then-President Donald Trump's first impeachment hearing. And I just now, in 2021, I want to ask you, do you think then-President Trump committed an impeachable offense regarding Ukraine, the quid pro quo, and should he have been found guilty in his impeachment trial?
Well, he certainly committed an impeachable offense, and you know, the whole process was underway, and myself and others who came forward as fact witnesses, you know, we did our duty, and the Congress had every right of oversight and of providing a check and balance. I mean, the problem, of course, is partisan politics. If this had been, you know, treated in a very, you know, serious fashion, I don't know whether he would have been impeached at the end, but certainly some form of censure or some kind of response to it would have been more likely, I think, had it not been treated in a purely political and partisan frame.
A truly diplomatic answer. Would it have been appropriate? You have 2 seconds to answer.
Yes, that would have been appropriate. I mean, look, I was a fact witness. I was not part of the overall committee. It was for them to decide.
Fiona Hill, her new book is There Is Nothing For You Here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.